Hey everyone, welcome into another episode of A Must-Win Game with Maggie Gray. On today's show, Peter King is my guest. He and I were colleagues at Sports Illustrated for 8 years. He was there a little longer than I was, but Peter became a great friend. And on this episode, we're going to talk about his new book, which is called The Game. Really cool idea. He goes back through all the 40 years that he covered the NFL and picks out one event from each of those seasons and then goes back and re-reports it. So he'll tell you a little bit about that. Also, we'll talk about Aaron Rodgers. We're going to talk about Tom Brady's impact on Fernando Mendoza. We're going to talk about the challenges facing Lamar Jackson this year, along with Dak Prescott and what Dak Prescott truly needs to show if there's going to be real optimism around the Dallas Cowboys. And then it kind of sounds like we're wrapping up the interview, but Peter goes on to tell this amazing story about traveling with John Madden in the Madden bus back in 1990. I wanted to keep that in because it's a really cool story. So stick around for that. Football fans are going to love this. And then after the interview is over, I just have a quick thing I want to say about the Jaden Daniels LSU jersey controversy, because I'm seeing a lot of commentary about this and people really skewering Jaden Daniels. And I think everyone has this completely backwards. So stay tuned after my interview with Peter. I'll address the Jaden Daniels controversy and let's get going. So we start off the interview with Peter talking about his new book. Again, it's called The Game. It's coming out in October. And Peter's telling me about a few of the stories that he revisits in the book.
Why did Reggie White choose the Packers in 1993? Why did the NFL do the strike games in 1987? Why did Paul Tagliabue cancel the games? I think, Maggie, I was the last. I think I might have been the last person to interview Paul Tagliabue before he died. And I did something about him. Why did he cancel the games and what did he fear after the attacks on the World Trade Center? I did a chapter on Ann McKee, the CTE doctor in Boston, who I had written about when I was at SI, but I went to visit her again. And the funny thing about Ann McKee, for people who don't know her, she probably has been the most important single person to bring the head trauma crisis to light, in the NFL. But I went to visit her in 2010 to write about her. We did a cover story for SI called Concussion Crisis. And she was terrific then. So I went back to visit her last fall in Boston. She's at Boston University. And her whole life has changed now, obviously. Nobody knew who she was in 2010. Now everybody knows who she is. But the amazing thing is, still on the bookshelf above her head are the bobbleheads of Aaron Rodgers and Brett Favre, because she's a cheesehead. And she grew up in Wisconsin and kind of still loves the Packers, but it's pretty sobering now with her. But anyway, that's kind of what I did. And it was really it was a lot more enjoyable the year and a half that I wrote this book than I thought it would be. And not that I thought it would be drudgery. I didn't. But I just sort of, when I headed into it, I said, man, I don't know if I'm going to like reliving all this. But honestly, I really, really did. It was a lot of fun.
Man, I cannot wait. It's such a great idea. And, you know, the concussion stuff is obviously incredibly sobering. And I would say probably one of the biggest changes in the NFL since at least in my lifetime of this concentration of trying at least to be safer, at least acknowledging the dangers of the game. You get Jackson Dart, even in a preseason game, having to go to the medical tent multiple times. But Peter, on a less serious note, I would offer this. I think the other biggest change to the NFL since 1984 to now, when you're writing this book, I kid you not, it's field goal kickers nailing 50-plus yard field goals with ease. And I know people listen to this say, oh, there's a Buffalo Bills joke in here. It's not even about that. It's not about Norwood. Yeah. I'm talking about when I was a kid, like a 40 yarder was kind of dicey. Now guys hit 50, 60. What do you think is the biggest change since 1984 to now?
I mean, I think that's as far as a football change, I think that is a very big one. I would say a couple of other things. I'd say football players basically having their own megaphones now. I mean, Maggie, I tell young people this in the media business all the time. I'm lucky. I'm not saying you're not lucky, but I'm lucky because when I got into it, my first chapter is on covering the Cincinnati Bengals in 1984, when 5 days before he coached his first game in the NFL, Sam Weich, I go in to ask him, hey, Sam, you're an amateur magician. You love magic. And he does. I'd heard all about it. And I said, and you have a very imaginative offense. I'm writing a story on you for the opening day of the season. And I would love it if you might put your tuxedo and your top hat on and allow us to take a picture of you. And he said, oh, yeah, I would do that. I'll do that. And then this falls in the category of, you know, you miss all the shots that you don't take. I think that was a Wayne Gretzky-ism, something like that. But I said to him, hey, Sam, and because this just occurred to me when I was talking to him and asking him, I said, if I got a rabbit, a live rabbit, how would you feel about pulling the rabbit out of your top hat? And he goes, and I waited for him to say, oh, you're not going to make a fool out of me. And I waited for him to say that, but he said, absolutely, I'll do it. So on the front page of the sports section of the Cincinnati Inquirer, opening day of the football season, September 1984, is a huge picture of Sam Weich in a tuxedo with a sheepish grin on his face, pulling a rabbit out of a hat. And Maggie, I'm just saying, you know, that's what Laura King always says. I'm just saying, Dad. I mean, I'm just saying that to me is one of the biggest changes, that it's very hard to do things with players that I was able to do over the years. And I that's one of the big changes.
Wait, hold on. Off of that, yeah. Though, I have, because you're reminding me of something. So Sam Weich knew you got to be a little bit of a showman. Every magician is a little bit of a showman. I'm not sure if you saw the recent article where The Athletic spent a day with Ben Johnson.
And oh, yeah. Really, hey, great story.
It reminded me of all those times when you used to do the ride along at 5 o'clock in the morning with all of the coaches. Yeah. And it was like a... I was feeling that nostalgia for when you used to do that style of story. And Ben Johnson has a little showman in him. And he's in the locker room after the games with the big speeches and taking off the shirt and all of this. I'm curious, like, Ben Johnson's kind of a fascinating guy to me. I'm not sure I ever heard a coach have a stated goal to a reporter. We want to be the highest scoring offense in the history of the league. And kind of put that out there. We want to have a break the Patriots winning streak. You know, we want to do and put all these goals out there. What do you make of Ben Johnson?
Everything about Ben Johnson I love, other than, you know, the just bizarre stuff he said about the Green Bay Packers. Just that was a little bit, to me anyway, that's not very appealing to me. I guess that's what he thought was appealing. It certainly is appealing to him and to his fan base. I love Ben Johnson. I think he's fantastic. I love him. He's kind of like a little bit over the top Sean Payton, because Sean Payton talks openly about, you know, how proud he is of, you know, scoring the most touchdowns over an X season period of time in NFL history, good for him. Everybody who does a job like that, Maggie, when I walked into a press box on Sunday working for Sports Illustrated, I'm covering Chicago, Washington, you know, in 1991, and it's Ditka Gibbs or whoever it is. And my whole thought at the time was, I got to write a better story, and I will write a better story than the Washington Post or Chicago Tribune will have tomorrow. And Maggie, it isn't that I thought I was better necessarily than anybody else, but if you don't have the goal to be the best at what you do, like Ben Johnson has a goal. He wants to be the best offense. Great. I think that's absolutely fantastic. Not only is there nothing wrong with it, I think it's phenomenal. I love that. I love somebody who talks like that, because what he's doing is he's putting the block on his shoulder and he's saying, come on, defenses, knock this block off. So I think it's great.
Yeah, I guess no one reminded him that the team that holds that record, the 2013 Denver Broncos, which he knew and he had their stats like right at the tip of his tongue, like that Super Bowl did not go the way they wanted to. What was the final score? 43-8?
43-8, yeah. That was in the Meadowlands.
I was there. You were there. We were all there. It was ugly. You know, you mentioned about Ann McKee, the famous doctor, you know, and her work with Chris Nowinski. And I feel lucky to call Chris a friend. And you mentioned she's a cheesehead. She's got Aaron Rodgers bobblehead behind her, Brett Favre bobblehead. Do you think Aaron Rodgers is going to be more relevant on the field this year or off the field?
Oh, you know, he's such a lightning rod that anytime he says stuff about Anthony Fauci, it's going to cross over into society. It's going to cross over into the larger media society. But I think he's going to play well. I really do. I think he and Mike McCarthy obviously know each other exceedingly well. They understand each other. They know, McCarthy knows when to push a button with Aaron Rodgers and when not to. So I think he's going to play well. Now, you know, what controversy will there be this year that he'll wade into? Because he'll wade into 9 of them. You know, I do think he's going to be, he's going to say a bunch of things this year that will make people say, oh, shut up or keep talking or whatever. But Maggie, I think one of the things about Rodgers, I thought you were going to say, do you think he'll be more notable this year as a player or next year, whatever he does with his life? And quite honestly, I don't know what he's going to do with his life. He doesn't strike me as the type who wants to be in a booth every Sunday, you know, or in a studio every Sunday. I think he'd be very, very good at it, extremely good at it. But he just doesn't strike me as the kind who would want to do that.
Yeah, except then the money gets involved, you know? And I didn't think that Tom Brady would be a guy who would want to do that. Not for the same reasons as Rodgers, but I wasn't sure that Tom Brady would want to be that guy, and he's embraced it. Tom Brady is everywhere. But, you know, I think where Tom Brady would probably be best served, Peter, is helping Fernando Mendoza. You know, Mendoza had a really nice preseason. I'm worried the Raiders are going to mess this up and not develop him in the right way. What impact do you think Brady can have on Mendoza, if any, and how do you see this pairing with this, what seems like a pretty amazing talent with a franchise that has been wayward for many years?
See, I think it's going to be hard for Tom to be very hands-on with Mendoza because, look, Tom has got his fingers in a lot of pies. And in order, if you want to be a real hands-on guy with a quarterback in the NFL, you got to be around, if not every day, almost every day. You can't just helicopter in once every, you know, week or once every 10 days or whatever. And that's one of the reasons why I think, you know, Brady has a good buddy of his, John Spytek, running the show in Las Vegas. And so he can have align into the team and out of the team. But in order to coach a quarterback, particularly, I don't know, Maggie, if you heard it, I heard a soundbite from Mendoza a week or so ago, how stunning it was to him, how hard it was to learn this offense and how complex the Kubiak offense is in Vegas. And so how can Tom Brady go in there when he's already got these guys with him for hours every day? And unless he's going to be there every day and sitting in the meetings and doing all that, I think his influence on Mendoza will be more between the ears than between the hash marks.
I mean, and that could be great, you know? That could be fantastic. Couple more for you. Thanks for doing this. I want to just go year by year through your book. A couple more. Lamar Jackson, Josh Allen, both with new head coaches who are doing this for the first time. Who do you think is going to benefit more from a new head coach? Obviously, it's a little different just because Joe Brady was already in the building. But Jesse Minter knows a lot about the Ravens also and has been working with the Harbaughs forever. But who benefits more from a new head coach, or who's going to have a tougher time here?
Well, I don't think things really have changed a lot for Josh Allen because he's got the same guy with him every day. Now, Declan Doyle, the offensive coordinator for Lamar Jackson, basically they're the same age. They're within a year or two of each other, aren't they? They're nearly the same age, I should say. And Declan Doyle is sort of he's very kind of conservative guy. He's not a very loud guy. He's quiet and very serious. And so Lamar has got to get used to A, a new offense, B, a new coach, and C, new coaching staff, I should say. And also, you know, I really think one of the reasons, and I don't know this, Maggie, but it's just a gut feeling that I had since it happened. I think part of the reason that Steve Bisciotti moved on from John Harbaugh is that he felt like his message was falling on deaf ears with Lamar. Lamar and John Harbaugh were not fast pals or anything like that. I think that Lamar wasn't crazy at the end about a lot of things happening with that staff, you know, and not just Harbaugh. But, and let me just say this, I do not blame any one person for that, but I'm just saying that sometimes you have a franchise player and you say, we've hit a wall. We're going to move on. And, you know, we'll see how it is. I have not been to their training camp. I've never met Declan Doyle. You know, so I can't tell you how good he's going to be. I just know that in my mind, when they made that change, I think that change was made with Lamar very, very prominently in mind. So I think the difference for Josh Allen is going to be minimal. And I think the difference for Lamar Jackson is going to be big.
I can't imagine you can have a more odd start to the season than Kyle Shanahan has had. This one is a little strange. Obviously, just happy that the guy's alive. Yeah. You know, it seemed like that car accident was really not a joke. Do you think this is a story that lingers throughout the season, or do you think that once the games start, this will be a footnote?
I think it all depends on Kyle Shanahan's physical condition, because Maggie, let's face it, you know, post-concussion syndrome affects different people in different ways. And who knows, you know, it's the middle of August. It's a month right now. Before the start of this, 4 weeks from the start of the season right now, a little less than that for the 49ers because they have to play in Australia on that Thursday. But I guess what I would say is that Kyle Shanahan, in my opinion, and this is how I view the 49ers, when people are saying, oh boy, he's going to miss the start of training camp. If you were to ask me what coaches could afford to miss a couple of weeks at the start of a training camp, I would say one of them certainly would be Kyle Shanahan. One of probably the biggest one would be Andy Reid. But I think Kyle Shanahan, number one, because there are so many people on that staff who've been with him for so long, you know, and so they know how to install an offense. Brock Purdy is, you know, he's whatever he is, 28 years old, going on 58. I mean, he's got the mentality of a 15-year veteran. He's an old soul. And so Christian McCaffrey, does he even need a coach? I mean, he's so driven personally, you know. And so in my opinion, and then obviously, you know, on the other side of the ball, you've got, to me, the best leader of all people on defense, post Ray Lewis, honestly, to me, that I've seen is Fred Warner. He is incredible. They got Dre Greenlaw back. I guess what I'm saying is, I don't think, I'm sure it has some impact. I don't think it's going to have a big impact because the people on his team, the players and the coaches on his team, I mean, you know, Raheem Morris, for crying out loud. He's, you know, he's been everywhere. He's been a head coach twice. So he's got all the people behind him. But I think it will be a problem if on game plan Mondays and Tuesdays, if he starts saying, guys, I got to go take a nap for 3 hours. I mean, so let's just wait until we get into the season to find out. You know, Maggie, the preseason has really changed a lot. Think about it. There's no more two-a-days. The days are not all that long. There's only three games. You got 2 weeks off before the start of the season. You know, the 49ers are flying to Australia a week before the season starts. Not to say that's a vacation. It's not a vacation. You know, they're doing it to try to get their body clocks right for that game against the Rams, you know, on the opening Thursday night of the season. But I guess what I'm saying is, I think it's impossible to know until the games start.
Yeah, it's like kind of this irony, right? It's like the preseason, you're kind of doing less, and training camp, it feels like it should be less taxing on your body, but then the season itself just never ends. I mean, I feel like even you brought that up early on, like the first couple weeks is just extended preseason of teams kind of feeling themselves out and feeling each other out of who are we? Okay, two more for you quick. One, I feel like normally I'd have to ask like an obligatory Dallas Cowboys question because the fan base is so big. But now, Peter, I don't know if it's so obligatory. I'm not sure about you, but I'm sensing some real optimism coming out of Dallas. Are you seeing and hearing the same thing, or do you think this is all just a Dallas hype machine?
Every year in August, ESPN crowns the Dallas Cowboys as something. This is the Cowboys' year. And to me, I don't really think this is any different. Why are the Cowboys any better this year than they have been? They might be. I don't know. But every year, people enter the season excited about the Dallas Cowboys. Maggie, at some point, I think there's three or four quarterbacks in football. Lamar Jackson is one. Justin Herbert certainly is one. But Dak Prescott is one too. He's got to play better in January in order to get to February, okay? And the fact is, if you look at the entire body of work for Dak Prescott in the postseason, it's not good enough. So, and again, I don't know how much we're going to learn from, you know, Giants and Cowboys week one. The Cowboys should beat them by 20 points. You know, so the optimism that's around the Cowboys to me is about the same as it has been every year. I might be wrong, but That's certainly what it feels like to me. Everybody loves the Cowboys in August.
Okay, last one for real, for real. What of the all extensive, you know, going back through your notes of writing your book and going back season over season, what is the story that you think fans today, like that most you can like pull, maybe like pull a thread between that season and now the 2026 season? Is there anything that comes to mind?
I'd say there's two things. Like historically, I think what happened in 1993 with free agency, it's so incredibly meaningful to modern NFL history. And because, Maggie, think about this. We are probably going to see baseball strike or have some sort of job action next year. And it seems to be a freight train rolling down the tracks. Okay. In 1993, Paul Tagliabue said to his hardliners, to the George Youngs of the world, to the Bill Polians of the world, you guys have got to cut this out about we can't have free agency. Because at some point, a judge is going to put it in. And in fact, David Doty, you know, the U.S. district judge in Minnesota who recently died, he, you know, put almost the baseline in for free agency. So in other words, free agency came. And if you look at free agency with a salary cap that really came into play in 1993 and 1994, that's the reason, why the NFL, Maggie, the first year I covered the NFL, national poll, Gallup or Harris, what's your favorite sport to watch in the United States? NFL 24, Major League Baseball 23. Maggie, the first year I covered the NFL, first year, 1984, there was a fall Sunday in October where the World Series was played. And it was Detroit and San Diego. And it went head to head. I think game five of the series went head to head with Dallas, Washington. Can you imagine which was at the time very likely the biggest rivalry in the NFL, okay? And or the most notable rivalry. The World Series game far outrated on television the Cowboys in Washington. I mean, and now the most recent poll, I think it was 41% NFL, 10% Major League Baseball. That, the fact free agency with a salary cap has been the biggest reason for that. That's number one. But number two, I do a chapter in 2009 on something called the calendar wheel. Okay. Nobody knows what that is. You don't know what it is. Nobody, it's never gotten publicity of any kind. But one of the things that Roger Goodell, that should go on his commissioner tombstone one day, is that he made the NFL a 24/7, 365 sport. And calendar wheel means we want to have the calendar of the NFL. We want to have stuff to go every week, year round in the NFL. And that's why, you know, the combine follows the Super Bowl by 2 weeks, and it has become a huge event. Then free agency 2 weeks later, and then the run up to the draft, and then all the mini camp stuff throughout May and early June. And one of the things I write is that, so what's the NFL doing now? Well, they're trying to occupy the dead period, late June, early July. Maggie, don't be surprised if one day the Pro Football Hall of Fame has its ceremony and its awards and everything in that dead period, because what sense really does it make for the NFL to have the Hall of Fame enshrinement, on the first or second weekend of training camp? I don't know. To me, it's like having the Baseball Hall of Fame thing on a Sunday in the regular season. Have it in sort of the dead period, so people can really have a holiday and really celebrate the game. But I think people will be surprised at the absolute, you know, efforts on behalf of the NFL to make this a 24/7, 365 game.
Peter, can I add on top of it the holidays? I mean, football and Thanksgiving obviously was, you know, would go hand in hand, but I think there's a lot of connective tissue to that, even going to high schools. Like high schools would have some rivalry games. You see some colleges have rivalry games around that time. The NFL took Thanksgiving long ago. They took Christmas. They're now taking Valentine's Day, for whatever that's worth. Yeah. I mean, every single...
And Black Friday.
Which has become
a national holiday in and of itself. And if you notice, Maggie, they don't put just any game. They put high-profile games on Black Friday. And so at some point, I think Rupert Murdoch and whoever ends up owning CBS or Paramount, I don't really follow that, but whoever ends up owning CBS is going to say, hey, remember us? We're the ones who made you really rich. Rupert Murdoch is going to say, listen, I got a great line in there about somebody in the NFL a few years ago seeing Rupert Murdoch somewhere and saying to him, hey, I really want to thank you for being such a great partner for the NFL. Rupert Murdoch kind of sneered and he said, I don't feel like your partner. I feel like your financier. And hey, listen, don't go feeling sorry for Rupert Murdoch. He built Fox on the back of the NFL. So there's anybody who feels sorry for Rupert Murdoch is a fool. I mean, he knows what he's doing too.
Yeah, the NFL, the Simpsons, and then obviously the cable news empire. Peter, this was really great. I am so psyched about your book, and I'm so psyched that it was like a labor of love for you and that you didn't find that it was such a grind. But how cool. And so glad you took copious notes and kept all those like organized and everything to go back to all of this. So cool.
Well, Maggie, you know, Bill Parcells read my book, and just about a week ago, he called me and he says, I just can't believe all this stuff you have in here. How do you know all this? And I said, Bill, I said, just remember one thing. I said, I had a great assistant. Her name is Rachel Lutz. She's been my assistant basically since I worked at NBC. She's fantastic. And she's almost like a private investigator. She can find anything. So I had her go back and find a lot of my clips. I said, hey, Rachel, I wrote about Larry Kinnebrew of the Bengals one night stealing a cheeseburger from Brian Pillman, a free agent trying to make the Bengals. Can you go find that story in the Cincinnati Inquirer in August of 1984? Within 2 hours, it was in my inbox. I mean, so... do I remember that? Yes. But the details, you know, I owe to Rachel Lutz, quite honestly, because she was able to go back and find everything over the years that, and Maggie, I have to tell you something. Yes, I kept my notebooks. I have them. Okay. But I don't have all my old covers, my old stories in SI. I wasn't a savvy person. I was always, let's move on to the next thing. You can't benefit in this job from saying, oh my God, what a story I just wrote. Give me all the love and all the credit. It's over. You got to go on to the next one, you know?
Man, and I'm so glad
that to me was extremely helpful to have an assistant come in and help so much.
Man, can I borrow her? Because I'm so glad you said that though, because I have like, I kept nothing. I'm also not a saver. I'm working in a daily show. So I'm always like, what's tomorrow's show? What's tomorrow's show? What's tomorrow's show? I never had space in my brain to keep old stuff. And Gary Player, the golfer, came into SI one day and he said, and we've never met before. He goes, darling, whatever you're doing here, this has got to be the thing that sets you up for the rest of your life. Like, you, this is cool what you're doing. I think he came in on a day when probably like Emmett Smith was there, someone else was in, and, you know, like something else. And he was like, this is cool what you're doing. This has got to be a part of your life for the rest of your life. And I was like, remember that. Peter, yeah. I didn't do anything. I went on to the next thing, trying to find these old interviews, and everything is like, it's like, yeah, you have to be an investigative journalist to go back and get them. And I'm glad that I've always felt bad about it and held on to a lot of shame about it. But the fact that you are also not a saver makes me feel a little better.
But, you know, the one thing that I was fortunate is that, you know, like my chapter, I wrote a chapter in 1990 about John Madden.
Yeah.
Because that was the year I took the bus ride across the country with him. Yeah. And I'm lucky because I remembered, you know, I pulled the notebook out and I took, because I got the feeling right away in that story that I was not going to quite get as much individual conversation time with him. As we're not going to sit there for 3 days and just talk. And so I made my observations, and I had some observations in there that really came in handy, like traveling across desolate Wyoming. And I pointed something out and I was writing it down, and I pointed out to Madden, and he goes, hey, listen, right off this exit that we're coming up to, you won't believe it, this is where the missile silos are. And one time I had to get off, we were getting coffee and I had to make a call, because remember, in the 80s, no cell phones. So he's got to make a call at a 7-Eleven in the middle of nowhere, Wyoming. And he comes in and he sees these guys coming out of armored personnel carriers to get coffee at the 7-Eleven. And he just can't believe it. But that is the kind of thing I probably wouldn't have remembered it had I not went back and looked at it in a notebook and looked at all my little observations about, you know, how desolate Wyoming was, for instance. But anyway, yeah, I kept good notes. I didn't keep good clips or good stories, good track of stories.
Well, as long as you've got Rachel, then you're all good. Yeah. This was fun. Let's do it again. I appreciate it so much. And just happy you look great. Happy that things are going well.
Thanks a lot, Maggie. Really appreciate it. Best of luck to you.
Thanks. My thanks to Peter King. That was a really cool John Madden story. I hope if you listen to it, now you realize why I had to leave it in, even though it kind of seemed like the interview was over. Okay, quickly, I want to address the Jaden Daniels controversy. So this one may have slipped by you. Jaden Daniels obviously is getting set for his third season as the quarterback of the Washington Commanders, but he has sent a cease and desist letter to his former university, LSU, where he won the Heisman Trophy in 2023. And basically, Daniels is pretty ticked off that they gave out number 5 to another player. They gave it out to a kid named DJ Pickett, who was fantastic last year in his freshman year at LSU. He won, he was a freshman All-American. He's a defensive back. And Jaden Daniels did not like the fact that DJ Pickett has now started wearing number 5. Last year, DJ Pickett was wearing number 3, because even though I guess LSU had maybe told DJ Pickett that he could wear number 5 eventually, Brian Kelly, who started last season as the head coach of LSU before he got fired in season, he was not going to give out Jaden Daniels' number. He coached Jaden Daniels to a Heisman. And also, he says that he's never given out number 9, which is Joe Burrow's number. And these are the two numbers of the two most recent Heisman winners for LSU, whose numbers have not been retired. For some reason at LSU, they do this like the Hall of Fame, where you have to be 5 years removed from your playing days to be eligible to get your number retired. I'm not really sure why they put that caveat in. That's not like a college football on the whole type thing, because obviously Shedeur Sanders and Travis Hunter got their numbers retired at Colorado like before they'd even taken a snap in the NFL. So Dion has different standards, I guess, than LSU, but that's neither here nor there. I think what I'm seeing, especially from the likes of Paul Feinbaum, I'm seeing this from a lot of the college football you know, cognoscenti, if you will, that Jaden Daniels has really messed this up, right? That Jaden Daniels, that his Heisman somehow is lesser than Joe Burrow's Heisman because Joe Burrow also led LSU to an undefeated season in the national championship. I think people have that all wrong. You know, Jaden Daniels didn't go out there and then play corner for LSU in a year when their defense was historically bad. I mean, the fact that Brian Kelly had such a horrible defense and really did not get it fixed is part of the reason why he is no longer the head coach at LSU. Why in the world would Jaden Daniels be taken down a peg or his Heisman deemed not as meaningful as Joe Burrow's simply because they didn't also win the national championship? And I think the other part of this that people are getting twisted is college football has always been big business, but that business has primarily left out the players. Everyone else was able to treat it like a business except for the players who had to play for free. So now the players are not playing for free and they're lawyered up. And they're treating it like a business. And my old co-host, Bart Scott, used to always quote his favorite cartoon, "Now the rabbit's got the gun." How about he's just treating this like a business now? Just like LSU has been treating football like a business for years and decades and generations. So to me, this all feels a little hypocritical for anyone who is, you know, calling out Jaden Daniels. I've even seen people suggest that his mom is behind this, which is, you know, I know his mom is ever present in his life, but who cares who's behind it? Somebody who's looking out for the best interests of Jaden Daniels is saying, listen, you promised that you wouldn't give out five. You've gone back on that promise. And now we don't want to be used and we don't want his image used for anything that's going to sell LSU jerseys, tickets, anything. You can't use him as a Heisman Trophy winner anymore to try to pump up your program. Because in his mind, he feels disrespected. Listen, it's a business decision now on both sides. And he wants his legacy cemented at LSU. They weren't willing to do that. All right, well, then you don't get to use my name for free now. Right? Or you don't get to profit off of anything that has to do with me. Listen, it's his prerogative. And clearly the relationship between LSU and Jaden Daniels isn't amazing. Or else you think that this could have been resolved before lawyers had to get into the mix. But now it has. I just can't get by on, and I can't stand by and listen to people really going after Jaden Daniels like he did something wrong here. If they're not giving out Joe Burrow's number, why would Jaden Daniels think they'd be giving out his? Okay, and that's just a little bit on what's going on with Jaden Daniels and LSU. If you are not following me on social media, oh, I wish you would. At Maggie Gray on Twitter, at Maggie Talk Sports on Instagram, and at A Must Win Game on YouTube. And if you are watching this on YouTube, if you could just hit subscribe, it's so easy. It's a very small thing, but it helps me out tremendously. We'll be back with two more podcasts this week. Until then, see ya.